Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining me in this presentation today. I am Michael Jegersik. I'm going to discuss a critical issue facing the legal profession, which is bullying in the legal field. The presentation, which I've titled "Order in the Court: Tackling Bullying in the Legal Profession," aims to shed light on the challenges we faced and to explore some solutions for a healthier, more respectful workplace. Maybe you haven't thought about the impact of bullying or considered it a problem, and I'm sure that there may be some people listening to this presentation that might not think it's a problem or have the old mentality that it's a tough profession, we just suck it up, or something to that effect. But it does have an impact on the mental health of those who have experienced it, and raising the awareness will hopefully have a positive impact on our profession as a whole. To introduce myself, I am a licensed practicing attorney in Pennsylvania, specifically Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, on the western edge. I typically handle dependency cases and some criminal defense. I've served as a prosecutor and a public defender, but starting in January 2025, I joined the education and outreach team of Lawyers Concerned for Lawyers of Pennsylvania, which is it's our lawyers assistance program here in Pennsylvania. I began as a volunteer with that organization in 2020, and I will be coming on as a full-time educator very soon here, but I have been serving in the educator role for over a year now. Our mission, the LCL mission, is to provide a caring peer assistance program to save lives and restore the health and professional competence of Pennsylvania's judges, lawyers, their family, and law students who may be facing mental health or substance use challenges. We offer confidential helpline services, volunteer support, and education to carry out this mission. I do talk about the services we provide in all my presentations. However, I realize that this presentation is not limited to Pennsylvania only, and I will add here that always consult the ethical rules in your state. LCL of Pennsylvania has been around since the late 80s, but at that time, not every jurisdiction had a lawyer's assistance program. Now, all 50 states do have some kind of lawyer's assistance program. They're not the same though. So although many lawyer's assistance programs may follow the same practices as LCL of PA, it's always advisable to consult the rules of professional conduct and the judicial code of your jurisdiction in order to ascertain the rules governing the duty to report misconduct imposed on both lawyers and judges, especially if there may be a connection to the misconduct and impairment as a result of alcohol, substance use, or mental health issues. I will give you a quick link. It's www.americanbar.org/groups/lawyer_assistance/resources/tap_programs_by_state.html. And I know that's a mouthful. I'm sure a search of directory of lawyers assistance programs by state should yield the same results, but they are cataloged at that website. There is the services that Lawyers Concerned for Lawyers provides in addition to the helpline, which again is 24/7. That may not be true of all jurisdictions, but in PA, you could call that helpline anytime, day or night, after hours, overnight, holidays. A real person will answer that phone. We have a very dedicated staff. And as our director will tell you too, we are 100% confidential. And if you are in a jurisdiction outside of Pennsylvania, you can still call LCL of PA. If you're not comfortable reporting in your own jurisdiction, we welcome calls from, again, lawyers, judges, their families, and about their families as well. We will try to get help to anybody who's reaching out and looking for it. And for us, that looks like free information and literature that we provide. We have a library that's accessible on our website, which is included in the materials. Any of those materials are available to PA lawyers. The pre-evaluations by healthcare professionals, assistance with interventions. I'm not going to get too deep into that, but it's not necessarily to say an intervention like you might see on TV. It's just a way that we can advise and help people if a colleague or a family member is experiencing a problem and we need to figure out a way to approach that person. I will mention the peer support again, because that's how I started as a volunteer and what that looked like for LCL of PA. When somebody calls in for some confidential help or needing to discuss what they're going through, they get connected with one of our over 350 lawyer volunteers who may have been experiencing a similar issue or having whether it's a substance misuse issue, a mental health issue. They will connect them with a volunteer who they think can best dialogue with that person to get them where they need to be. And again, these are all free, confidential, non-judgmental, and non-obligatory services. And I did mention attorneys calling in for problems with mental health, and that's really the core of this program. I'm going to show that the effects of bullying on the people who feel like they're being bullied or have reported experiencing that can lead to serious mental health issues, and why that's important for attorneys, based on the studies that show the prevalence rate of those issues in our practice. And just to be clear, about 74% of the calls that we take at Lawyers Concerned for Lawyers come in with a primary presenting issue of mental health. That is not to say that there is not a co-occurring or secondary issue of self-medication or substance use or alcohol use or overuse. But just to say that primarily the issues that people are calling in today are stress, anxiety, grief, mental health issues that they're having trouble dealing with. And that has been a rising trend since before the pandemic, and it continues in that direction to this day. Again, we offer anonymity and protection. You can remain anonymous and still receive our services. We do not report or disclose any identifying information to any court, judicial conduct board, disciplinary board, board of law examiners, or any other agency of the court, nor do we report or disclose any identifying information to state or local bar associations or any judicial or law-related organizations. We do not report any identifying information to anyone without your prior consent. And with that, I will get into sort of the meat and potatoes of today's program, which is how are we going to foster a culture of respect and professionalism in the legal profession? And workplace bullying, it's been defined as repeated unreasonable behavior directed towards an employee or group of employees that creates a risk to health and safety. And I mentioned the idea of we're supposed to be tough and we're supposed to be sort of a profession where pressure is expected. So while the legal profession is inherently adversarial in litigation, this should not extend to internal or interprofessional relationships. There's a study that I get most of my, if I mention a percentage of attorneys reporting bullying or you know, categories, things like that. Most of that I sourced from a study entitled Bullying in the Legal Profession, a Study of Illinois Lawyers' Experience and Recommendations for Change. And it seems to be the most comprehensive and recent study that I found that was done in 2023. And it could be linked at www.tocivility.org/bullying in the legal profession. And again, if you receive the materials, you should have a link to that. And again, I keep referring to this study because outside of its comprehensiveness and recency, it's also a good touchstone for the types of behavior we'll be looking at. And with that, this study found that one in four lawyers have experienced workplace bullying during a one-year period. So that's 25% reported that they were subject to that repeated unreasonable behavior directed towards them over a year. And the study included 6,010 Illinois lawyers who participated, and it was conducted and commissioned, or excuse me, for the commission by the Red B Group. Their definition was of bullying was inappropriate behavior intended to intimidate, humiliate, or control the actions of another person. Bullying may take many forms, including verbal, nonverbal, or physical acts. And that was their whole definition. So that is specifically what they were looking at. And you know, I intended the emphasis on intimidation and humiliation, because that's the seriousness of what we're dealing with here. There's seven most reported types of bullying that this study found were verbal intimidation, such as insults, name calling, or shouting, harsh belittling or excessive criticism of work, demeaning nonverbal behaviors, the imposition of unrealistic work demands, behind the back malicious rumors, improperly taking credit for somebody else's work, or the subject was not receiving important work information or being excluded. The bullying is disproportionately affecting younger lawyers. So 39% of lawyers aged 25 to 35 were bullied, compared to 12% of lawyers aged 60 to 75. It's not clear to me whether they studied a reluctance to report it as you increased in age. In other words, perhaps it seems fair to say that an older lawyer might be a little more reluctant to admit to being bullied. However, that 39% of young lawyers is a staggering number. That again, almost 40% felt that they were bullied to the point where they were reporting it. Another breakdown showed that 38% of female lawyers were bullied, compared to 15% of male lawyers. And that brings us to our first specific topic here, which is the gender divide. And we're going to talk about what's termed the leaky pipeline theory. And it relates to the, despite women entering law school in equal or greater numbers than men, significant disparities persist in leadership, pay, and retention. Sexism undermines careers, limits diversity, and compromises fairness. Manifestations include unequal pay, limited advancement, dismissive behavior, double standards, and client bias. The impact can be profound. It could lead to career stagnation, mental and emotional toll, financial disadvantage, reduced confidence, and a severe work-life imbalance. So addressing these issues requires leadership accountability, regular feedback, pay equity. And I'm going to break this down a little further here. So some of the key points on this leaky pipeline theory, again, as I said, women are entering law school in equal or greater numbers compared to men, indicating a strong initial interest and capability in pursuing a legal career. But despite the equal entry, when it comes to the early career, women are facing challenges such as sexism, bullying, and unrealistic work demands. Those challenges can lead to higher attrition rates among women in the early stages of their legal careers. As it progresses to the mid-career, that's when women are encountering systemic barriers such as gender bias, unequal pay, and limited advancement opportunities. These barriers contribute to the glass ceiling effect. I've done some research on that, that the idea of a glass ceiling, the term itself comes from the 20th century, but it could go back into the 1800s. There was a French phrase I'm not going to try to pronounce here that will that idea has been around that women are limited in how far they can advance in their career, and it can be difficult for them to advance to senior positions. And once they get to those leadership and senior roles, the disparities become more pronounced, with fewer women in leadership roles such as partners, judges, and senior counsel, despite them entering the field at a greater rate than men are. And this underrepresentation is often due to a combination of career stagnation, lack of mentorship, and this impact of sexism and gender bias. And how does this impact the profession as a whole? Well, it's not just affecting those careers. It's limiting diversity of thought. It compromises the profession's commitment to fairness. And the legal profession can lose out on the valuable contributions and diverse perspectives that women bring to the table. To define sexism in the workplace, I'm defining that as discrimination based on gender. Sexism being prejudice, stereotyping, or discrimination, typically against women, on the basis of sex. In the workplace, it manifests as unequal treatment or opportunities due to one's gender. That also includes gender bias, whether unconscious or conscious, that is favoritism towards one gender over another. Sexism includes gender stereotyping, that's attributing certain characteristics, roles, or abilities to individuals based solely on their gender. For example, that women are emotional and that men are decisive. Gendered expectations, imposing different standards or expectations on individuals based on their gender. And systemic barriers, which would be policies, practices, or cultural norms that disadvantage one gender. And I realize the topic is gender discrimination, and it seems like I'm focusing only on gender discrimination towards women. I realize it can be experienced by men and any other gender that somebody is identifying as. Other marginalized groups can be the subject of gender bias. But the reason I do put a lot of focus on women is for what I found interesting on this next slide, which in the materials I included a map of when women first gained the rights to practice law in America. And if you count it out, there's over 10 states, not including U.S. territories that we acquired later on. So I don't know how they calculated those years. Some of those places, it wasn't into the 60s that and 70s that women were admitted to practice law. But in just the 50 states, there's over 10 jurisdictions where women were not allowed to be admitted to the bar until after 1900. And the year that all states had allowed admissions of women was 1920.
Esquire CLE's first verification code is TUB, T-U-B, all lowercase, TUB. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is TUB, T-U-B, all lowercase, TUB. Please take a moment and write this down.
And even though that was, you know, by that point, a woman could have taken the bar in any state. Delaware did not have a woman admitted to their bar until 1923. And I don't want to disparage them, but from what I looked at, that's the latest that a woman was admitted. And that's just over 100 years ago. The first woman was not admitted into the U.S. until 1869. And that was, if you're curious, Arabelle Mansfield of Iowa. And that may seem like a long time ago, but the fact is that there were lawyers here in North America before we incorporated the United States. And a lot of those lawyers came from England, and they only beat us by 1 year because in 1919, they allowed women to practice. So while we can sometimes see ourselves as culturally advanced and some the idea that a woman would not be allowed to practice law is probably very would be strange to most of us. It was not that long ago that they were completely excluded from the practice. And I think that's where a lot of this bias stems from. How does this sexism manifest in the workplace? Well, there's unequal pay and compensation. There are gender gaps persist for similar work and experience levels. There are limited advancement opportunities. There are fewer women, as I said, in leadership roles. Back to the idea of a glass ceiling. There, women can be subject to dismissive or undermining behavior, including being interrupted more frequently in meetings, having ideas ignored until they're repeated by a male colleague. And I'll give you a new term that expresses that idea, which is he-peating. And again, it's in the materials. Being mistaken for administrative staff or being assigned less substantive work or what they refer to as pink collar tasks. Further manifestations, there are gendered expectations and double standards. One of those being that women can be penalized or looked down upon for assertiveness, in other words, termed bossy, while men can be rewarded for that same behaviorship, coined as a leader. Expectations for women to manage office or social events, or to carry the emotional labor of the office, the implicit bias against mothers or caregivers regarding commitments and ambition, and there's client bias has been found where clients sometimes prefer or implicitly trust male lawyers more, which again is going to impact the opportunity of non-male attorneys. And to delve further into the impacts of sexism, career stagnation and attrition. We're seeing women leaving the legal profession at higher rates, particularly when they get to senior levels, due to lack of advancement opportunities and hostile environments. They are reporting a mental and emotional toll, which is increased stress, anxiety, issues with imposter syndrome, burnout, and feelings of inadequacy due to due to constant microaggressions and systemic barriers, and those issues of imposter syndrome, burnout. We at LCL have specific programs just addressing those effects specifically. So they're already increased stress, imposter syndrome. Those are affecting our profession as a whole. And again, women are leaving the profession because they feel those effects amplified. Financial disadvantages, lower lifetime earnings and wealth accumulation due to pay gaps and the slower progression or advancement. Reduced confidence and ambition. These sexist environments can erode self-belief and discourage women from pursuing leadership roles. It could lead to a work-life imbalance where women are, they're often expected to bear a disproportionate share of domestic and caregiving responsibilities. And then that's compounded by inflexible legal work cultures. There's an underutilization of talent, where the profession loses out on diverse perspectives and valuable contributions when sexism limits opportunities, and erosion of trust, where there's a lack of faith in the firm's commitment to equity and fairness. Why does it persist in the legal profession? Why does sexism persist? It's partially due to traditional and patriarchal structures. The legal profession, again, I will refer you back to the map. The legal profession has historically been male dominated, leading to entrenched norms and power dynamics. Unconscious bias or implicit biases about gender roles, leadership styles, and competence influence. So those things influence hiring, promotion, and daily interactions. And I will speak more about implicit bias and get into a definition of that later, because it affects all of the people who are reporting bullying as a whole. There's a lack of transparency or opaque processes for compensation, promotions, and work assignments that are hiding gender disparities. And what's been termed a likability penalty, where women who are assertive or ambitious can be perceived negatively compared to their male counterparts because they're not likable. Now, how do we address this leaky pipeline? It's essential to implement strategies that promote gender equity and support women through their legal careers. Some of the strategies are addressing pay equity and transparency. An employer could conduct regular pay audits and ensure transparent, equitable compensation practices. Have comprehensive bias training, where there's mandatory ongoing training on unconscious bias, gender stereotypes, and microaggressions for all employees. I'll mention here too, again, depending on the jurisdiction you're practicing in, I believe that some jurisdictions have built into their rules of ethics they necessitate that kind of ongoing training to address some of these issues. So again, in general, if you have that, you should check your local rules to make sure that you're complying with that. And then we could go back to the ways to address it. The parental leave and support should be offered. Offer generous, gender-neutral parental leave policies and support for returning parents. Parental leave for males has become way more common, but I myself have heard people speaking in a sort of a judgmental way when it comes to fathers taking paternity leave. And it goes back to the patriarchal sort of old school structure. Those are the comments that I've heard, that like, wow, I can't believe he's taking time off for this paternity leave. We also need to look for leadership accountability, to hold leaders accountable for fostering gender equity and diversity within their teams and the firm, and have regular feedback and dialogue to create safe spaces for open dialogue about gender issues and actively solicit feedback from women. So there's an importance here to educate yourself and to understand the nuances of sexism, gender bias, and the impact that they have on the profession. So our goal, again, is to foster a culture of inclusion and respect and promote an environment where all genders feel valued, heard, and respected. And by addressing these issues, the legal profession can work towards closing the gender gap and ensuring that women have equal opportunities to succeed and lead. And the next topic of sexual harassment obviously has ties to gender bias. And I'm going to define it as a form of bullying involving unwelcome conduct, offensive jokes, intimidation, and interference with work performance that's of a, you know, physical or sexual nature. And I started practicing in 2006, so I'm basically a child of the 80s and 90s, and it seemed like there was this explosion of awareness back then of sexual harassment. Like out of nowhere, it was all over pop culture. It was showing up in movies and TV shows. Every TV drama on the major networks had an episode that was talking about sexual harassment or dealing with that issue. And it seemed like it led to a lot of education and training being implemented back then. But it's not, at least my perspective, it's not in the forefront as much as it was back then. Again, as a child, I seem to be more aware of it and hear about it on a more regular basis than I do now in practice. And I realized that almost every workplace had implemented, as a result of that, they implemented some sort of sexual harassment policy, or, you know, HR reporting guidelines, those kind of things. But I think possibly because it's fallen out of the mainstream to some degree, that people think it's an issue that doesn't still need to be addressed, and that's not still happening. And admittedly, even in my, from 2006, it seems, less acceptable, but it's from personal experience, I have seen court administrators and president judges have to draft letters addressing it to court staff and to attorneys, so it is still ongoing and worth mentioning. It could come in the form of offensive jokes, slurs, epithets, name calling, physical assaults or threats. And by physical assault, I'm not talking about something necessarily, you know, that's going to result in bodily injury, but a touching, or even a touching, however slight, intimidation, ridicule or mockery, insults or put downs, offensive objects or pictures. We live in a meme culture, and some people share things more freely with others, and to some degree there's been this emboldening of, oh well, you know, can't you take a joke, right? Or I didn't create that, I'm just sharing it. I think that's a new aspect that we're all dealing with, is when somebody sends something that is outright or maybe borderline offensive, how do we deal with that? Interference with work performance because of these distractions can be a problem. And the hierarchical structures that I mentioned before, the traditional law firm and court structures, can foster environments where junior members feel unable to challenge senior figures. And this is a recurring problem in a lot of areas where the people in our profession, some of us strive and work so hard to get into a job that's difficult to get, right? A job that there's a lot of competition for. Maybe it's a particular firm or a high-end government position that's, very difficult to get in there. And we have this feeling like once we're in there, we cannot step on any toes, and we have to stay in there. So when these issues are coming from the top, or senior partners are engaging in this, and then the firm culture becomes, oh no, well, that person, that's just the way they are. And it leads to that feeling of that there's no effective way to challenge it. Many lawyers experience the long hours and the high stress. That exhaustion and pressure can lower inhibitions and increase irritability, making individuals more susceptible to both perpetrating and experiencing misconduct. And that old boys club culture, male dominated, leading to entrenched attitudes and resistance to change regarding gender equity. Why is the legal profession vulnerable? Well, we have to worry about client confidentiality and reputation. So we don't want to damage client relationships. We don't want to be known as the person, the troublemaker in the firm, or somebody who's bringing negative attention to the firm. There's a fear of retaliation. There's no clear. The retaliation could come in the form of career repercussions, being blacklisted, losing opportunities, and there might not be any clear reporting mechanisms. And if they do exist, there could be a lack of trust in their effectiveness. And now I will mention that, again, many places, especially the larger the organization, is going to have some sort of HR policy or a reporting policy. But this could be a particular problem for, solos or smaller firms. There could be increased pressure in those situations, especially when it comes to a client crossing lines, because in a situation, well, for a smaller firm, the pressure might be, hey, we have to keep all the dollars in the door, so you're just going to have to put up with so-and-so. Again, that's just the way he is. It might make you a little uncomfortable, but we need the business. For a larger firm, it may come in that, it's just a different scale. Like, this is our most important client. This is an account we can't lose. So you just have to, we as lawyers get used to that idea of dealing with what we might write off as nuance or quirks, but it's actually harassing behavior, and it could be affecting people in a way that seriously impacts their mental health. This study, to move on, found out that 38% of lawyers with a disability reported being bullied, and that was compared to 23% overall over a year. And again, I do not, I'm not going to delve too far into that, except to say that if, again, almost 40% of lawyers with a disability are feeling that they are being unfairly treated, that's something that should be addressed. And the next group that I'm going to address, the LGBTQIA. So the study addressed that bullying affects lawyers with disabilities, LGBTQIA plus, and lawyers of color at higher rates. Homophobic and racist bullying is typically subtle, or it's could be in the form of microaggressions, which I'll talk about later, but it's a real impact, and it erodes trust And it creates unsafe environments, and it forces people again to hide them, their authentic selves, and that is the concern. There is a mental health impact. So 29% reported being bullied related to their sexual orientation, and that's compared to 3% of heterosexual lawyers. So a great disparity based on sexual orientation. Homophobic bullying presents specific challenges for LGBTQIA plus legal professionals. It can lead to the professional facade where subtle remarks disguised as jokes or banter or professional feedback can make this kind of bullying difficult to identify and address. It has an impact on trust and safety, eroding trust and creating an unsafe work environment. Again, making people hide who they really are. There's targeted hostility where homophobic bullying is repeated, unwelcome behavior directed at an individual because of their actual or perceived sexual orientation or association with LGBTQIA plus individuals. The forms this takes, which again is often subtle, it could be verbal, offensive jokes or slurs, demeaning comments about an individual's partner or lifestyle, or outing somebody without their consent, and persistent questioning about their personal life, or in the form of exclusion or isolation, where these individuals are deliberately excluded from social events, networking opportunities, or professional development based on their sexual orientation. And I have absolutely zero intention of bringing any politics into this, and if it's possible, less intention of bringing religion into this. And no matter what personal beliefs you hold, it seems that we've moved into this realm, again, not what I was used to when I began my career, where people are, they're sort of emboldened to challenge others on personal matters that I found to be traditionally off limits. And I'm not asking anyone to set aside personal beliefs, but it's just to consider how these are not job or performance related issues. And they should be off limits. Like I said earlier, sexual harassment was in mainstream discussion before I entered the workforce, and it focused on unwanted sexual advances, but it sort of became clear that the workplace was not an appropriate forum to discuss any matters of sex or sexuality. And now, again, we have a study from 2023 showing that 29% of non-heterosexual lawyers are using that word bullying to describe the conduct. So I do think it's worth mentioning that these things should absolutely be off limits in the workplace, because it's having this huge effect. Why does it persist? And I've mentioned implicit bias a couple times here at this point. I'll just give you the American Psychological Association definition, that implicit bias, also known as implicit prejudice or implicit attitude, is a negative attitude of which one is not consciously aware against a specific social group. Implicit bias is thought to be shaped by experience and based on learned associations between particular qualities and social categories, including race and or gender. Individuals' perceptions and behaviors can be influenced by the implicit biases they hold, even if they're unaware that they hold such biases. Implicit bias is an aspect of implicit social cognition, the phenomenon that perceptions, attitudes, and stereotypes can operate prior to conscious intention or endorsement. And that can manifest in subtle discriminatory actions or preferred treatment. Some of these biases based on sexual orientation stem from a don't ask, don't tell mentality or an unspoken expectation that personal life should not be discussed, particularly for LGBTQIA plus individuals, which can lead to a culture of silence. And of course, a fear of retaliation, concern that reporting homophobic bullying will negatively impact career progression or relationships with clients or overall an attorney's reputation. Some suggestions for creating a queer inclusive legal field are, again, education to try and understand some of the nuances of homophobic bullying and its impact, the promotion of inclusive language, where it's encouraged to use inclusive language such as asking for pronouns or just avoiding assumptions about partners or about orientation, to try to be an active ally where if you observe any sort of homophobic remarks or actions, even if subtle, to speak up and support your colleagues. And it is our collective responsibility to ensure that this legal profession is a place of justice and respect for all of its members. I realize that these are, there's an evolution to these topics, and they are very personal to people on all sides of the discussion. But what I would like to see is just everyone who's gone through the things that we've gone through to become an attorney, to go to make the grades, to get through undergrad, to get through law school, to pass the bar, that everyone who has put themselves through that rigor has the opportunity to practice in a safe and fair environment. Moving on to lawyers of color, the study reported higher instances of bullying. For one example, 36% of Middle Eastern or North African attorneys reported bullying, 35% Black African American reported bullying, 34% of Hispanic attorneys reported experience bullying. And this is a persistent reality. Despite advancements, racist bullying remains a significant, often insidious challenge people from various racial and ethnic backgrounds to those people in the legal profession. We're going beyond overt acts. It is not always overt. It often manifests as subtle biases, microaggressions, and systemic barriers. It has an impact on equity and justice. These behaviors undermine individual well-being, hinder career progression, and compromise the legal profession's commitment to justice and equality. Again, it can be verbal, racial slurs, derogatory terms, quote-unquote jokes about race and ethnicity, mocking accents, questioning individuals' intelligence or qualifications based on race. Again, as far as all these things, I'm not making a general comment on what should be considered out of bounds here. And I realize that there's people who, people of all colors who appreciate different humor and different jokes, but we're talking about in the workplace here. And I think it's fair to say that if there's even a slight question about whether something is appropriate to say, the answer is probably don't say it, right? Outside, what sort of, media you consume is completely up to you. But again, it's the workplace. It shouldn't be where we're trying to explain to somebody why something is not racist or why it's funny. There's exclusion and isolation where we're deliberately excluding individuals because of their race or ethnicity from informal networks or client meetings, social events, or other information that's critical for career advancement. Further defining racist bullying, there's professional undermining where we're assigning less desirable or diversity tasks, withholding challenging work, denying mentorship, sponsorship, or giving unfair criticism rooted in racial bias, stereotyping, making assumptions about an
Esquire CLE's second verification code is LAB, L-A-B, all lowercase, LAB. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is LAB, L-A-B, all lowercase, LAB. Please take a moment and write this down.
Individual's abilities or work ethic or interests based on racial stereotypes, systemic nature, this racist bullying is often reinforced by broader systemic biases and institutional practices within the legal field. And I have mentioned that term now, microaggressions, defined as subtle, often unintentional comments, actions, or behaviors that communicate bias, stereotypes, or negative attitudes towards members of marginalized groups. They can manifest as offhand remarks, dismissive gestures, or seemingly innocuous questions that over time contribute to feelings of exclusion and undervaluation. The meaning of these, they're brief and commonplace exchanges that intentionally or not convey prejudiced messages to individuals based on their identity, such as gender, race, sexual orientation, other aspects of difference. They often reflect underlying societal stereotypes and can be expressed verbally, non-verbally, or environmentally. Now, again, some examples could be a question like, "Where are you really from?" Or, "You're so articulate for someone like you," and or possibly confusing individuals of the same race, or exoticizing or tokenizing a colleague because of their race or ethnicity. And the impact of these microaggressions, they take an emotional toll. Repeated exposure to them can lead to stress, frustration, and diminished sense of belonging or self-worth. There's professional consequences because in the workplace, these microaggressions undermine inclusion, hinder career progression, contribute to higher turnover rates among affected groups. They can have a cumulative effect. And while a single microaggression may seem minor, the cumulative impact can be profound, affecting well-being, engagement, and overall mental health. They can perpetuate inequity by reinforcing systemic biases and maintaining barriers to equity and inclusion with organizations and society at large. So recognizing and addressing them is crucial for fostering environments where all individuals feel respected and empowered to thrive. The impact of these racialized biases, there's a psychological burden. It can cause chronic stress, anxiety, depression, imposter syndrome, again, from constantly navigating and internalizing racial biases, creates a double consciousness where the mental burden of constantly code switching or monitoring one's behavior and anticipating racial prejudice. And I don't define it, I don't think, in these slides, but code switching is where a person changes the way they speak to another based on that other person's ethnic or gender identity, meaning there's actually a change in how we communicate with that other person. Career stagnation and exit, these disproportionate rates of racialized professionals are leaving the legal field or struggling to advance to senior positions, again, due to systemic barriers and hostile environments. Opportunities are limited. They could be overlooked for high-profile cases, for leadership roles, or for client relationship-building opportunities. It takes an emotional toll, and there's this expectation to educate colleagues on racial issues, and there is some personal emotional cost there. There's an erosion of trust, or a deep sense of distrust in the firm's commitment to equity and the fairness of internal processes. Again, why does it persist in the legal profession? the existence of implicit bias and stereotypes, those unconscious biases about race. They can influence hiring, promotion, mentorship, daily interactions. There's a lack of diversity in leadership. Predominantly non-racialized leadership often lacks lived experience or understanding of racialized experiences, hindering effective anti-racism initiatives. And a meritocracy myth that this legal profession is a pure meritocracy that can blind individuals to systemic barriers and racial discrimination. There could be a fear of calling these things out. Nobody wants to be labeled too sensitive, or, you know, again, that whole suck it up attitude. You're an attorney. You should be able to handle this kind of thing. They don't want to face retaliation for reporting incidents. There could be insufficient anti-racism training, and training often focuses on general diversity rather than specific actionable strategies for dismantling systemic racism and addressing microaggressions. And again, client biases, where firms can inadvertently or even intentionally cater to those biases, which impacts opportunities for racialized lawyers. Again, if it's an important client who's requesting an attorney of a certain ethnicity or rejecting an attorney on that basis, sometimes it could be hard to say, to confront that client and say that no, we're going to do things the right way, not the way that you want them. What are some of the strategies for systemic change? Again, explicit anti-racism policies, develop and enforce policies that specifically address and prohibit all forms of racial discrimination and bullying, including microaggressions, ongoing training. So implement comprehensive training for all levels of staff, focusing on those implicit biases and systemic racism, the microaggressions, and effective bystander intervention. And diverse and inclusive leadership, where active recruitment, retention, and promotion of racialized individuals into leadership and decision-making roles can address this. Be transparent in reporting and accountability. Establish clear, confidential, and trusted reporting mechanisms with guarantees against retaliation. Safeguard the reporting individual. Ensure prompt, thorough, and impartial investigations. Start mentorship or sponsorship programs where there's a structured program specifically designed to support the career development, advancement of a racialized legal professional. And again, I'll come back to fostering that positive work culture. That's the whole idea here, to promote open communication among team members, to build trust and encourage effective collaboration, right? Not sit down and watch this video and now you're done, right? It has to have an impact. Recognition and motivation, where we're regularly recognizing and rewarding achievements to boost morale and inspire motivation among employees, and support that work-life balance. Every program that I do addresses work-life balance, and it is a serious problem in our profession. I have a study that I'm not going to get into, but just to briefly say that a study was conducted in 2015 by an attorney and certified addiction counselor named Patrick Krill that showed that attorneys face substance use, alcohol use, and mental health impacts at crisis levels compared to the average person. That study has been redone, and I bring it up to say I'm recording this in the late winter of 2026. Very soon, I don't know when you'll be listening to this, but soon, hopefully in spring, that study has been done again, a comprehensive 35 jurisdiction study. Tens of thousands of lawyers participated, and we will have an update on those, on the way that these issues impact our career. But That's why I talk about bullying. It has a mental impact, emotional consequences, resulting in anxiety, depression, low self-esteem. It impacts the victim's emotional well-being, creates feelings of isolation, which is a isolation is a huge problem for attorneys facing any of these issues. We tend to sort of draw out of the public eye and keep these problems to ourselves. There's a risk of self-harm, suicidal thoughts, which have been reported, again, much higher for attorneys than the general population, and it underscores the need for intervention and support. We experience these elevated rates of depression, anxiety, and substance abuse compared to other fields. We have these long hours, these high stress factors, so anything we can do to improve the mental well-being of our profession, I think we need to focus on. And again, that is why I wanted to bring this issue of bullying to the forefront. If you have the slide materials, you could reach our website. Again, my name is Mike Yagursik. I could be reached at mike@lclpa.org if you want to email me with any questions or follow-up. And I appreciate you sitting through the presentation today. And with that, I will say goodbye.